Here we are, back with Evening Under Lamplight, the show, and I know of very few others, that invites you to attend. We listen to other shows, we even dance with the music, but, well, attending is something else. We all remember the Latin root of the word now, don't we? At, or ad, means towards, and tendo means to stretch out, and so when we attend, we are stretching out. Not quite relaxing, but not straining either, just stretching, making a little effort to move closer towards something, but leaving enough distance for us to see what we're attending to. When we dance with something, or someone, we merge ourselves with that other, but when we attend, we come close but keep our identity and the identity of the other just a little bit separate. That's what we call aesthetic distance. And that's what we're inviting you to here, if we can manage it. An aesthetic experience, an appreciation of beauty in lots of different ways. So please, you are invited to attend Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge Community Radio, Cambridge 105, with your host, Robert Louis Abrahamson, producer, compiler, engineer, and presenter. All for, well, I was about to say all for you, dear listener, but I realized it's not that. Much of it is for me, too. My pleasure as well as yours, I hope. Let me know at lamplight@cambridge105.fm and on our website, momentsunderlamplight.com. But enough of this jive. Let's get going. Our last show, you will recall, featured the mythical god Pan. And of course, Malcolm Geit said to me when he heard of the theme, of course you played the Water Boys. Well, actually, they were only a name to me, but Malcolm and then Matt Russell were both so persuasive that I went home and listened to the Water Boys for several days running. That's how you do it. Be obsessive. And then you stop to let it sink in deeper. I spent 2 days away from the Water Boys and then went back to the music, and it was like a sparkling reunion, all coming alive. And I listened to The Pan Within and The Return of Pan, and I thought I'd better make up for my omission last time by playing one of these songs this evening under lamplight. Let's listen to The Return of Pan. Last time I mentioned the role of Pan in Tom Robbins' novel Jitterbug Perfume. Pan fading away and dying as fewer people believe in him after the age of Christianity, and then the Enlightenment. But he persists and leaves a legacy, that wildness found in all things, sunshiny, lewd, and cruel, as Stevenson had put it. And here in this song, we meet a man standing upon a balcony with my brand new bride in some far-off honeymoon site, perhaps some remote hillside in Greece. And then, in our sight, something moved, lightning-eyed and cloven-hooved. The great god Pan is alive. He caught a glimpse of the shining divinity, just the sort of thing you want to see on a honeymoon, the mythic shimmer shaping this retreat with just you and your brand-new bride and the goatish Pan energy. Well, let me run through the rest of the lyrics to make it easier for you to attend carefully to the performance. He moves amid the modern world in disguise. It's possible to look into his immortal eyes. He's like a man you'd meet any place until you recognize that ancient face. The great god Pan is alive. At sea, on a ship, in a thunderstorm, on the very night that Christ was born, a sailor heard from overhead the mighty voice cry, Pan is dead. So follow Christ as best you can. Pan is dead. Long live Pan. From the olden days and up through all the years, from Arcadia to the stone fields of Inishir, some say the gods are just a myth. But guess who I've been dancing with? The great god Pan is alive. I like those final lines, that daring rhyme of the strong noun myth and the weak preposition with, and the colloquial guess who. all pushing us in expectation towards the concluding line with his triumphant shout, "Some say the gods are just a myth, but guess who I've been dancing with? The great god Pan is alive."
Balcony with my brand new brand. The clink of bells came drifting down the mountainside. When in our sight something moved, lightning eyed and cloven hooved, the great god Pan is alive.
In case you weren't attending, that was the Waterboys with The Return of Pan. And did we mention last time that other great appearance of Mischievous Pan in The Boy Who Never Grew Up, Peter Pan playing on his pan pipes out there in Neverland? Yes, he belongs there too, though the vehicles through which he comes to us, the sentimental play by J.M. Barrie and the silly cartoon of Disney, are perhaps unable to contain the true energy of this mythic creature. I don't want to spend the whole show on Pan. We did that last time. Instead, I want to shift slightly to a related mythical figure, Hermes, or Mercury. We had a show a few years ago on the Hermes Moment, a show that was allowed to go on for an extra half hour, breaking the limits in typical Hermes style, and at the end of the show I mentioned that there was so much more I'd like to say that I'd probably come back to the subject later on. Well, here we are. Let's spend the rest of our evening here together looking at some aspects of Hermes, or Mercury, the trickster god, a mythic figure like Pan associated with goats and wildness, and often, too, with priapic erections. In ancient times, you would often find little statues of Hermes called Hermes, with its goatish erection that, I think, you were meant to stroke in passing, just for good luck. We don't do such things these days, or at least not in plain sight. But before we go further, let's review the many aspects of Hermes. Hermes is the god of so many things, and if we attend carefully, we may catch a glimpse of the deep wisdom of the ancients, who saw that all these different human activities and traits emanate from the same spirit, which they personified as Hermes or Mercury, or, of course, by many other names in different mythologies around the world. The energy that unifies all his different aspects is the energy of the trickster, the spirit that gives us just what we had not expected and sweeps us off our secure perches, but always in order to show us something good for us, something we could never have discovered if we'd kept on the course we thought was best for us. Hermes is the name we give to that energy bringing us the message from above about how to find our heart's desire. And in what areas of our lives does this trickster energy come to us? In travel, commerce, money, theft, and language, especially fancy rhetoric, hype, deceit, lying. Also, borders and limits, fences, and especially the crossing over the boundaries. And Hermes speaks to us through dreams, not nightmares, but those dreams that carry meanings. He's the god of transformation, especially alchemical transformation, that is, refining the base elements into precious gold, taking the mean and ugly parts of us and turning them into glowing and valuable expressions of our deepest selves. And as is fitting for the god who is also associated with caves and holes in the ground, he is the psychopomp, the one who leads the soul down to the underworld after death, which in the mythic sense signifies that he is the energy that takes us deep into our own unconscious, where we find true answers. But most of all, as the messenger of Zeus, all the messages he brings are divine messages. He is always the bringer of good fortune. The Greek goddess Tyche, good fortune, was thought to be a daughter of Hermes. And if I were looking for one word to sum up this amazing, complex energy pattern, I'd say indirection. Polonius, though a fool, knew that we can, by indirection, find direction out. Hamlet was better at that game, and that's because he knew how to play and play with it. In fact, let's call it playful indirection. Both Polonius and Hamlet, however, discovered what a risky game it can be. But when we get involved with divine energy, of course it's going to be risky. So where do we start attending to this playful indirection? Oh, I know. Let's look at language first, and the clever use of language. Not just words, but the language of music, too. And at the same time, I'd like to celebrate the wonderful Levon Helm, the drummer, and so much more of the band, who died very recently. Many people are paying tribute, and I'd like to do that, too. And we'll do this with the song Ophelia, one of the best of the band's later songs. It's a lament for the disappearance of Ophelia, who's left town suddenly. No one knows why. But it's not a mournful lament, certainly not. Like all the band songs, We can attend to every instrument and hear it playing with the melody and the beat, playing its own extravagant game, while at the same time also fitting in as part of the large routine. And the words are among the most playful that Robbie Robertson has written. The rhymes are always unexpected, and the way in each stanza he works in the name Ophelia in a different way each time is the essence of wit. Let's run through these words before we hear the song. Boards on the window, mail by the door, why would anybody leave so quickly for? Ophelia, where have you gone? You see, Ophelia's on the move. She's traveling. There's one Hermes connection. The old neighborhood just ain't the same. Nobody knows just what became of Ophelia. Tell me what went wrong. Was it something that somebody said? Mama, I know we broke the rules. There's Hermes again, breaking rules. Was somebody up against the law? Honey, you know I'd die for you. Ashes of laughter, the ghost is clear. Why do the best things always disappear, like Ophelia? Please darken my door. They got your number, scared and running, but I'm still waiting for the second coming of Ophelia. Come back home. And please, attend to Levon Helm's voice, rustic, drawling, pleading, but having a great time pleading. He's singing at the same time as he's drumming. He was known for that, and with his head turned sideways into the mic. In direction, of course.
Thank you.
That was the band and Ophelia, one of Levon Helm's bravura performances on vocal. Thanks, Levon. One of the things Robbie Robertson does in that song is play around with catchphrases. We usually tell someone never to darken the door again, but he begs Ophelia, please darken my door. She sounds like trouble, but the kind of trouble we want around. And then he says that he's still waiting for the second coming of Ophelia. A kind of blasphemous reference to the messianic second coming, daring us to take offense. If we refuse to play and instead take offense, we are the poorer for it, out in the cold. And this playfulness with catchphrases reminds me of Jim Steinman's songs, and we bring him onto the show in order to salute him, who, this very month, will be given an honorary degree from our college, Amherst. I think that's appropriate. He took the verbal wit we all played with in our Amherst days, and combining it with a Wagnerian epic settings, gave it to a larger audience as Bat Out of Hell. Let's attend to the song with the ambitious title of You Took the Words Right Out of My Mouth on a Hot Summer Night. As usual, Jim takes a cliché, You Took the Words Right Out of My Mouth, and twists it around, exciting us with the sexual possibilities. You took the words right out of my mouth. It must have been while you were kissing me. Uh-huh. But in the end, there's one further twist, as so often in his songs. A move to an emptiness, a failure to complete. The boy was just about to say he loves her, and then they kissed, and he couldn't say it. Why not? Was that adolescent love burned out by the power of the kiss? In the end, he's just a boy. You know, one of those who's up for it until the sexual excitement has to be grounded in some real feelings. And then, well, then Hermes takes the magic away. You hold me so close that my knees grow weak, but my soul is flying high above the ground. I'm trying to speak, but no matter what I do, I just can't seem to make any sound. Verbal impotence for all that verbal wit. If our soul is flying high above the ground like that, we lose touch with Hermes, the god of caves who grounds us. Too bad, kid, but Hermes has to trick you back to your senses. But meanwhile, you might as well celebrate this verbal impotence with musical wit. And so let us attend to the Phil Spector Richard Wagner high passion here. I'm sorry I won't be at Amherst to see Steinman get the degree, but I can imagine his mischievous and humble grin as he does whatever one does at such things. And hey, Jim, mazel tov. Here's Steinman himself at the start of the song, with Marcia MacLean teasing each other and us as a kind of spoken overture to the operatic passages to come, sung, of course, by Meatloaf.
On a hot summer night, would you offer your throat to the wolf with the red roses?
Will he offer me his mouth?
Yes.
Will he offer me his teeth?
Yes.
Will he offer me his jaws?
Yes.
Will he offer me his hunger?
Yes.
Again, will he offer me his hunger?
Yes.
And will he starve without me?
Yes.
Then does he love me?
Yes.
Yes.
On a hot summer night, would you offer your throat to the wolf with the red roses?
Yes.
I bet you say that to all the boys.
Shooting stars falling through your tent.
So there was our tribute to Jim Steinman with You Took the Words Right Out of My Mouth on a Hot Summer Night. Now let's move to two poems celebrating this hermetic, mercurial indirection with language. Emily Dickinson was a trickster poet, playing with diction and meter and imagery, and although for most of her adult life she never crossed the boundaries of her father's land, he did own 11 acres, though, in the center of Amherst, she made up for it by crossing the boundaries of conventional thinking and writing in every poem she wrote. Here she tells us that the best truths must be delivered by indirection, or slant, as she puts it. We have to go round in circles, only gradually working out the meaning, because truth's superb surprise is too strong for us to take in all at once. Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success in circuit lies. Too bright for our infirm delight, the truth's superb surprise. As lightning to the children eased with explanation kind, the truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind. And another poem, this time by Robert Graves, called In Broken Images, a poem contrasting the solemn, clear person who goes directly to the point, and the playful, self-doubting person who is the one in the end who grows into new understanding. The poem builds through paired lines, describing first the one person, then the other, apparently images of each other, but actually broken images. They are not similar, we see, but completely opposite. In Broken Images. He is quick, thinking in clear images. I am slow, thinking in broken images. He becomes dull, trusting to his clear images. I become sharp, mistrusting my broken images. Trusting his images, he assumes their relevance. Mistrusting my images, I question their relevance. Assuming their relevance, he assumes the fact. Questioning their relevance, I question the fact. When the fact fails him, he questions his senses. When the fact fails me, I approve my senses. He continues quick and dull in his clear images. I continue slow and sharp in my broken images. He, in a new confusion of his understanding, I, in a new understanding of my confusion. That was hosts Mercury from the Planets with Sir Colin Davis and the London Symphony Orchestra to follow up from Robert Graves' poem In Broken Images. And speaking of broken imagery, you're listening to Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105, Cambridge's community radio. And I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, helping you attend to Hermes energy this evening. Graves was talking about the necessity for us not to be sure of ourselves, but to linger in doubt and let understanding arise out of our confusion. Stevenson says this is the only way we can have true communication. We must be aware that the words we use to communicate are only inadequate tools. I try to express my thoughts and feelings in words, but I can never fully express my meaning, and then you, poor thing, have to work to move through my inadequate words to get as close as you can to my meaning. It's hard work for both of us. Everyone, Stevenson says, everyone who lives any semblance of an inner life thinks more nobly and profoundly than he speaks. And the best teachers can impart only broken images of the truth which they perceive. Speech which goes from one to another between two natures, and what is worse, between two experiences, is doubly relative. The speaker buries his meaning. It is for the hearer to dig it up again. And all speech, written or spoken, is in a dead language until it finds a willing and prepared hearer. I like the image of our having to dig up the speaker's words. What is that? Like the pirates in Stevenson's Treasure Island, out to dig up buried treasure? Yes, though for some it is like the two medical men in Stevenson's story The Body Snatchers, who dig up the freshly buried corpse so it can be dissected, taken to bits, and analyzed. In neither case, though, are they digging to bring back something to life. And that's a shame. But there is a moment in Stevenson's fiction where we do find men digging up a buried body to bring it back to life. At the end of the novel, The Master of Ballantrae, when, using some ancient lore of India, the devilish Master of Ballantrae has himself buried in a state of suspended animation. Stevenson did research into this to get his details right. And in the frozen wastes of northern New York State, the body is dug up again. Let's move in as Secundra, the Indian servant of the Master of Ballantrae, begins to dig up the master's grave after his apparently dead body has lain in it for a week. The frost was not yet very deep, and presently the Indian threw aside his tool and began to scoop the dirt by handfuls. Then he disengaged a corner of a buffalo robe, and then I saw hair catch among his fingers. Yet a moment more, and the moon shone on something white. A while Secundra crouched upon his knees, scraping with delicate fingers, breathing with puffed lips, and when he moved aside, I beheld the face of the master wholly disengaged. It was deadly white, the eyes closed, the ears and nostrils plugged, and the cheeks fallen, the nose sharp as if in death. But for all he had lain so many days under the sod, corruption had not approached him. And what strangely affected all of us, his lips and chin were mantled with a swarthy beard. Every moment the form of the master, swathed in his buffalo robe, grew more distinct in the bottom of that shallow trough, the moon shining strong, and the shadows of the standers-by, as they drew forward and back, falling and flitting over his emergent countenance. The sight held us with a horror not before experienced. I dared not look my lord in the face, but for as long as it lasted, I never observed him to draw breath. And a little in the background, one of the men, I know not whom, burst into a kind of sobbing. Of the flight of time I have no idea. It may have been 3 hours, it may have been five, that the Indian laboured to reanimate his master's body. One thing only I know, that it was still night, and the moon was not yet set, although it had sunk low, and now barred the plateau with long shadows, when Secundra uttered a small cry of satisfaction, and, leaning swiftly forth, I thought I could myself perceive a change upon that icy countenance of the unburied. The next moment I beheld his eyelids flutter, the next they rose entirely, and the weak old corpse looked me for a moment in the face. That was the Hindu chant Purnamada from Ravi Shankar's album Chants of India. It is a prayer of wholeness, an affirmation of the unity of all things, the deepest meaning we can come to after the hard work of digging through the inadequate words and diagrams. And Hermes, the god of burial, is also the god who transforms and lifts us up, bringing us to see the divine message of this unity. An affirmation of the unity of all things, the deepest meaning we can come to after the hard work of digging through the inadequate words and diagrams. And Hermes, the god of burial, is also the god who transforms and lifts us up, bringing us to see the divine message of this unity. And Hermes, let's not forget, is also the god of theft, another kind of indirection. Theft is terrible, of course, a kind of indirect assault upon our very being, but it need not be quite as threatening as we can see in the next poem I'd like to read to you. It's a poem by a dear friend and colleague of mine, Karen Yelena Olsen, who just sent me her latest book of poems, And Life to You, Elegies in a Foreign Land, containing fine illustrations by another colleague, Jerry Glover. Many of the poems speak of Karen's life in Crete as someone part of the local community and also a little apart from it. This poem is about Vasiliki, an old woman who was always stealing little things from her neighbors. A true handmaid to Hermes, Karen says, that impish god of thieves. In the old days she'd been so deft, true handmaid to Hermes, that impish god of thieves. Who in our village had not woke to a missing broom, or casserole, or spoon? Once, passing by her door, I smiled to see my thermos discarded on the floor, object as alien as that plastic pen I'd let her snatch, a gaudy lure left out to tempt her magpie eye. Her other neighbors, less amused, still somehow knew her thievery, compelled, not willed. And so they sighed or cursed and sometimes set about retrieval. Sophia, searching in vain for the watering can, would frown and call out, Spiro! Her little boys soon learned the art of swift and stealthy seizure, triumphant repossession. Years of this. We learned to latch our doors or else we marched, no longer knocking at the gate, into her single, dirt-floored room, came out clutching our dishpan, ladle, pail. Vasiliki did not protest. Silently she watched each object leave, its loss no more a mystery than its arrival in her own unknowing hands. And then the palsy came upon her. At the start, a minor tremor just enough to spill her tea or send her fork clattering to the floor. Later, through our curtained windows, we watched her spindly legs tottering down the lane, cane gyrating, her shrinking frame a leaf fluttering in an imperceptible wind. At first we felt relief, yes, and a sour smile at her decline. The days of theft forever gone. But then, as weeks went by, her kitchen slowly filled again. Sophia dropped by to tend the scraggly plants, and I to sweep the floor. Her sprinkler leaned against the wall, my broom behind the door. Even Anna, always so irate, brought eggs in a wicker basket, butter too. Her fry pan stayed on the stove, and from the old nail beside the sink, her faded apron hung once more. Of all this we never spoke. But towards the end, when she no longer rose from the rickety corner bed, we took turns feeding her, our surer hands guiding spoon to mouth, while her fingers twitched and roamed unceasing over the threadbare sheet. In the end, her death was just a slow cessation of vibration, her ancient limbs shuddering less and less, her quivering lips and eyelids still at last. So now we've laid her out and called the priests, the distant daughter. The room is bare again. I, too, turn to go, but then, as an afterthought, decide to leave the broom, a grave gift to Hermes, guide of all our trembling souls. Following Karen Olsen's poem Vasiliki, we heard Jack Latzer playing Paganini's Mercurial, Caprice No. 13 in B-flat. But now, what about our Kinks song and our Dylan song? I know some listeners tune in for no other reason than because they know they'll get to hear the Kinks and Dylan. Well, the Kinks song takes us to Hermes as God of Boundaries, or rather the God of the Edge. It's a song about going over the edge, pushed beyond any kind of safety zone, pushed even into insanity. It's a kind of love song, wriggling under the pressure put upon him by the weird relationship with a woman whose demands are sending him over the edge. "We all play roles," he says, "but the ones you ask me to play are getting too much for my mixed-up emotions." But then Ray Davis shifts to a wider perspective, a kind of report about the way the whole world is being pushed to the edge. Is it comforting to hear him singing in 1993 that the world is falling apart in just the way we are afraid it's falling apart today? The world is turning upside down, civilization's dead. Economic turmoil, now the world is in the red. Democracy is a shadow of its former glory. Law and order's broken down. End of story. And then we shift to the local scene again as we see how his neighbor has gone over the edge. Here is Hermes in the suburbs, knocking people out of their security. "My next door neighbor's totally snapped. He's gone right over the edge. He's putting up barbed wire barricades around the garden hedge and planting landmines on the lawn. He's gone barmy. According to his wife, he's formed a secret army. Ever since he got laid off, something inside snapped. His wife said he's gone round the twist. Now there's no turning back. All night he waits in the garden shed for the enemy to attack. A suburban vigilante dressed up in a Union Jack. He's over the edge."
pressures of society are getting to your brain and force you to act with and put me under all this strain. But don't drive me over the edge of it. Stop while I've still got emotion. Join the crowd just to be part of it. That was the start of it. Ooh, now I'm over the edge. Don't drive me over the edge of it. Ooh, over the edge. Don't drive me over the edge of it. Everybody is a victim of society. Comedy, tragedy, vaudeville variety. Pantomime players in the grand tradition. Forced into roles that leave them totally driven. Right over the edge.
The Kinks, Over the Edge, from their final album, Phobia. And the Dylan song takes us to Hermes, the Oneiropomp, the bringer of dreams, with the song A Series of Dreams. There's no time this evening to go far into the hermetic and mercurial associations here, but attend to the way the song depicts what Joseph Campbell calls a dream landscape of curiously fluid, ambiguous forms, where we can find no foothold, but must just hold on as best we can. A place where the time and the tempo fly, and there's no exit in any direction except the one that you can't see with your eyes. And in the end, you find you have gone the distance simply by thinking of a series of dreams. Just attending takes you farther than you could have imagined. So thanks for attending this evening under lamplight on Cambridge 105, community radio in Cambridge, with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson. There were several different mixes of A Series of Dreams to choose from, and I've chosen the one with the most insistent drums right up front, haunting and pushing us until we too have gone the distance, just thinking of A Series of Dreams.
Of a series of dreams, where nothing comes up to the top. Everything stays down where it's wounded and comes to a permanent stop. Wasn't thinking of anything specific, like in a dream where someone wakes up and screams. Nothing too very scientific, just thinking of a series of dreams. Have a series of dreams where the middle and the bottom drop out, and you're walking out of the darkness and into the shadows of doubt. Wasn't going to any great trouble. You believe in it's whatever it seems. Nothing too heavy to burst the bubble. Just thinking of a series of dreams. Thinking of a series of dreams. where the time and the tempo drag. Suddenly, the gate is thrown open, and you're left there, holding the pain. Was it making any great connection? Was it falling for any intricate scheme? Nothing that would pass inspection. As you're thinking of a serious dream, dreams where the umbrella is folded into the path you are heard. And the cards are no good that you're holding, unless they're from another world. In one, the surface was frozen. In another, I witnessed a crime. In one, I was running, and in another, all I seemed to be doing was climb. Was it lucky for any special assistance? Not going through any great extreme. I'd already gone a distance, just thinking of a series of dreams.